This is the International Anthony Burgess Foundation podcast. Anthony Burgess was one of the most important and prolific British writers of the 20th century. Most famous for his dystopian vision, A Clockwork Orange, he wrote 33 novels, 25 books of non-fiction, and over 250 musical compositions. This podcast aims to illuminate Burgess's life and work, and his connections to other 20th century literature, film, and music. So join us as we explore the world of Anthony Burgess. In this episode, we explore Anthony Burgess's new collection of essays on music, The Devil Prefers Mozart, with the editor Paul Phillips. The Devil Prefers Mozart is the first collection of Anthony Burgess's essays on music and musicians. This wide-ranging anthology covers classical, modern, and operatic works, as well as jazz, pop, heavy metal, and punk. This episode of the podcast discusses the versatility of Burgess's writing on music, the different sorts of essays in the new collection, and what Burgess really thought of the work of the Beatles. Paul Phillips is the Gretchen B. Kimball Director of Orchestral Studies and Associate Professor of Music at Stanford University. He's the author of A Clockwork Counterpoint, The Music and Literature of Anthony Burgess, the definitive study of Burgess's music and its relationship to his writing. Paul has contributed essays to 6 books on Burgess, including the Norton Critical Edition of A Clockwork Orange, and he's an honorary patron of the International Anthony Burgess Foundation and its music advisor. The Devil Prefers Mozart is published by Carcanet and out now from all good bookshops. Head to the description of this episode for all the relevant links. Here's Andrew Biswell, who spoke to Paul Phillips about editing The Devil Prefers Mozart in March 2024.
Paul Phillips, welcome to the Burgess Foundation podcast. It's a great pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Andrew. Wonderful to be here.
Perhaps I could begin by asking you about your own journey into Anthony Burgess's music, how you first became involved in researching and performing that music.
My journey into Burgess began, like just about everyone else's, I think, through his novels. And I grew up reading as much Burgess as I could get my hands on. And then what happened was in 1993, he passed away, and the New York Times published an obituary in which Burgess said, and I'm paraphrasing, "Everyone thinks of me as a novelist who writes music on the side. I wish they'd think of me as a composer who wrote novels on the side." And that was really the trigger. I wanted to know, okay, what was this music? And so I tried for 2 or 3 years to find it, and by writing to all his literary publishers. Those were all dead ends. And then through a quirky series of events that happened around 1996, 3 years later, I was put in touch with his widow, Leona Burgess, and she ended up inviting me to Monaco. And there were the manuscripts. And I realized that 2 things. 1, this was an amazing collection of music. And 2, unless Leona Burgess invited you into her home in Monaco, you had no way to actually see the manuscript. So somehow the universe had put me in this position. And I thought, well, I can either just walk away, or I can delve into it and find out as much as I can. And I chose the latter, and it's been a fascinating journey ever since.
Tell us a bit more about the circumstances of your going to Monaco. I mean, presumably his apartment was there pretty much as he'd left it. And were the manuscripts on the desk or filed in the study? How did you discover these things?
Well, there were 3 residences in Monaco. There was the big residence, I think was a 4 or 5 story walk-up. And that was the really grand apartment where Anthony lived with Leona. By that time, it was tough, I think, for Leona to climb the stairs. And so they had purchased across the street in an elevator building 2 additional condominiums. So Leona lived in one of them. I never did see that one. And then there was the grand apartment across the street where a secretary, a literary secretary, worked and that was where most of their personal belongings were. And then there was a third apartment in the elevator building, and that's the one where they placed me. And it was full of his books that he had written, many, many, many copies, extra copies of the books. So, you know, dozens or maybe even hundreds in some cases of copies of his later books, many of the books in his library by other authors, and then a cabinet filled with music manuscripts. And these were all original manuscripts. Most of them, there were no copies. There were just the manuscripts that were there. Liana wasn't there for the first few days that I was there. That caused a bit of a problem because at the very last moment, I was told that I could not come because Liana was out of town. And then there was a series of phone calls, and she agreed to let me come, and the two women who were kind of friends or working for her, they kind of oversaw the logistics. And then after about 4 or 5 days, then Liana showed up, and then she was with me about 10, 12 hours a day for the rest of the time I was there. There was also a house in Lugano, and it became clear during that trip to Monaco that there were many manuscripts in Lugano. And we arranged for to travel to Lugano to see those. And Liana had not been to the Lugano house since Anthony had died. And so I think she was hesitant to go, but she did agree to go. But then at the last moment, there was a glitch in the plans, and we never did go to Lugano. At that moment, I thought, oh, that's terrible shame, and I'll never get to see those manuscripts that were in Lugano. But in the end, I got to see them all because they wound up in Texas.
Texas is important because, as you say, it's the major repository of Burgess's music manuscripts and other manuscripts now. And I understand you were involved in helping to catalog the collection once it had arrived in Austin.
The following year, I was very keen to go back to Monaco and to, you know, to continue the work because I'd only gotten started there during the couple of weeks that I was there. And when I called Liana, I asked if I could come back, and she said, there's no reason to come back. Everything's gone. And I said, where did it go? She said, it's in Texas. And that's all she said. And Texas is a big place. And so I was really perplexed. And after a few moments, she gave me the phone number and the name of someone that I should call. And I called this person, and they worked at the Harry Ransom Humanities Research Center at the University of Texas at Austin. And she explained that Liana had sold most of Burgess's manuscripts and writings and letters to this center, and that they had received some 136 or 134 boxes of materials, and they were just trying to figure out what to do with them. So it turns out that the Humanities Research Center would give out fellowships, and so I applied for one of these fellowships. And once that was granted, then I went down to Austin and was able to see what was in all these boxes and played some role helping the librarians figure out what went with what, and made some sense of the music, since very few people had ever seen the manuscripts up until the time I happened to stumble into that Monaco condominium.
We should say, for the benefit of people who don't know your work already, that more perhaps than anyone else currently living, you've done a huge amount of work in performing and preparing for performance Burgess's orchestral music and other pieces, first through your work at Brown University and more recently in Stanford. Maybe you could just tell us what have been some of the highlights of that that performance work you've done as a conductor and arranger and general promoter of Burgess's music.
I think it's worth saying at the outset that when the composer writes out the orchestral score. There's a lot of work that has to get done before that score can actually be played by an orchestra. So the immediate problem that I faced was, how do I convert these scores into sets of materials that orchestras can play? So starting in the late 90s, early 2000s, a lot of work went into just creating these editions. And so there's a wonderful concerto for piano and orchestra that had never been performed before. There's a cantata, a song for St. Cecilia's Day. That's another piece that had never been played. A Manchester Overture is another one. So all of those pieces, I was able to lead the first performance of those. And that was all quite exciting. And those are excellent pieces. Some have been recorded now, some haven't. Mr. W.S., the ballet suite on the life of Shakespeare, that had been played before, and the BBC had gotten the materials, the orchestral materials, done for that. I was able to rent them from the BBC and perform them in the U.S., and we've recorded that piece. For a year or so, I collaborated with the Boston Conservatory Chamber Players, and this is a group of great musicians based in Boston, and we did several concerts, all Burgess concerts, one in Boston, one in Providence. So these are some of the highlights.
We should turn to the new book, The Devil Prefers Mozart, this compendious collection of Burgess writing about music and about his own music, and that's clearly grown out of your previous work. The book, the Clockwork Counterpoint, where you've given a very detailed account of Burgess's life as a musician and as a composer. Perhaps one way into the book would be to ask you, who were the composers whose work he valued, who excited him, and about whom he wanted to write?
The dominant British composers of the late 19th century, early 20th century, were really the ones that Burgess was... felt very connected to. Gustav Holst, William Walton, Frederick Delius. Somehow, Ralph Vaughan Williams less so. It's funny because some of Burgess's music really does show the influence of Vaughan Williams, but he tends to downplay that a little bit in his writings. I think he also had a somewhat ambivalent attitude toward Benjamin Britten, but Holst, Walton, Delius, these are composers that Burgess loved and whom he wrote about, and there are essays on all of them in The Devil Prefers Mozart. He also was very fascinated by earlier composers like Handel, and he wrote quite a bit about Handel. In fact, some essays were left out because he wrote so much about Handel. Burgess also was, of course, fascinated by, slightly obsessed by Beethoven. No surprise to anybody who's ever read A Clockwork Orange. Wagner is an important figure for Burgess, but even some composers one wouldn't necessarily associate with Burgess. Monteverdi, for instance, or Gluck, or Kurt Weill. Stravinsky is the subject of several of his essays. Of course, Burgess prided himself on writing about anything that anyone offered him a chance to write about. So there's an essay on the hurdy-gurdy. I don't think that Burgess was a particular fan of the hurdy-gurdy, but, you know, it was a challenge for him. And so, you know, he would accept such a challenge. And so we have an essay on the hurdy-gurdy. We have one on food and music, which is one of the funniest pieces in the whole book.
Yeah, you're right. It's a very rich collection from many points of view. It's interesting, too, you mentioned Elgar. He says, I think, towards the end of the second volume of Confessions, that he feels Elgar is almost in his blood. It's a very close connection. He says that he could write Elgar's Third Symphony for him, which really leads me to ask about how closely linked or not are the composers he's animated about on the page and his own musical writing. Can you see connections between Burdus's composer and Burdus's music critic.
Absolutely. I think there's a close connection to Walton, maybe even more than Elgar. I mean, he loved Elgar. He was frustrated that Elgar wasn't appreciated more outside of England. And some of his writings about Elgar were written for the French press, in which he goes on about why doesn't Elgar translate, across the channel. He accepts that he doesn't translate very well, but he's not 100% sure why. Walton used a larger orchestra than Elgar did, and used brass bands and loved to make a huge racket in his music. Burgess likes the same thing, and so Burgess uses a slightly more 20th century orchestra than Elgar did, but the nobility of Elgar's music does show up in Burgess's ballet for Shakespeare, for example, in his symphony. But Burgess uses a slightly more modern vocabulary than Elgar did. Burgess likes chordal harmonies quite a bit. That's something we associate with Paul Hindemith. And Elgar never wrote in chordal harmonies. So there's a difference there between Burgess and these earlier composers that he loved so much. And it's funny, even though his music has a kind of a harmonic quality associated with Paul Hindemith, he almost never mentions Paul Hindemith. So I always wonder whether that was something that was just so subconscious he didn't even think about, or it was an association that he preferred not to point to so that people wouldn't make the association on their own.
We should say something about the title of the book. One of the essays is titled "The Devil Prefers Mozart," and it's a very amusing piece written for a popular newspaper about the Bishop of New York had condemned heavy metal music, and this is Burgess's response to that. Maybe you could tell us how this piece is representative of his writing about music.
Sure. Well, Burgess came to be known as the godfather of punk, and this was a label that he abhorred. It came from William Sapphire, who was a columnist for the New York Times, and he talked about how punk music was destroying society, and it all is the fault of Anthony Burgess because he wrote A Clockwork Orange, which was turned into this terrible movie that spawned all of this punk and heavy metal music. Well, Burgess was horrified by this and made it his mission for several years to show that this was not the case at all. And so he wrote a number of pieces that explained his dissatisfaction, his dislike of heavy metal music. And this is one of them. So this is The Devil Prefers Mozart appeared in the Evening Standard, talks about the Archbishop of New York, Colonel John O'Connor, who has solemnly damned the cult of the rock music known as heavy metal. Burgess writes, "He alleges the devil rampages in it and leaps into the souls of its devotees. Two cases of apparent demonic possession have been exorcised in New York in the past few months, and heavy metal music, according to His Eminence, has had something to do with both." And Burgess goes on to talk about Ozzy Osbourne and Motorhead and Iron Maiden and Saxon. And he goes on to say, "We must try to take Cardinal O'Connor seriously." Burgess's main problem with heavy metal music is its volume. It's just simply too loud for him. He says, "We have to divide all music, not just rock, into the inner and the outer. If music is played at a volume of 100 decibels, it can make the adrenaline gush, quicken the heartbeat, and especially in combination with alcohol, arouse very violent instincts. This is the outer aspect. Play the scherzo of Beethoven's Ninth at an excessive volume, and you will promote equally mindless aggression," and so forth. So this is Burgess going on about music and the volume. I have to say, I kind of agree with him. I don't agree with everything that Burgess says, but the volume of heavy metal music has always made it hard for me to listen to. So this is one point of agreement.
And at the end of the essay, he actually comes through with the music he does like. He talks about Cole Porter and George Gershwin, which I guess it's some of the music he'd grown up listening to. And he's, you know, there's a clear preference for, I don't know how much time he spent listening to Iron Maiden. I suspect not very much, but where he ends up is affirming, you know, the kind of music that's moved him and I guess influenced him in his songwriting.
And then in that last paragraph you mentioned, he says, we've come a long way from the time when, with the music of Richard Rodgers, Cole Porter, and George Gershwin, the world, young or old, could have tunes in common. There is in pop or rock a watery neutrality that can only be given a semblance of meaning by being equipped with a heavy, monotonous beat. It is suitable for the unformed young, and it is to be despised more than feared. Noise is a different matter. His eminence is right there, but the devil has better things to do than respond to its inanity. The Prince of Darkness is an intellectual, and he likes Mozart.
Provocative stuff, yeah.
Yes, Burgess never held back.
Joyce comes into this book as well. There's the essay titled Musicalizing Ulysses, where he writes about the process, the impossible task of trying to boil down this 900-page novel and trying to give it a sort of dramatic form as an operetta, which he did. And as you've said, it was broadcast on British and Irish radio in 1982. Most people won't have heard it, I think. So maybe you could tell us a bit more about it and give the flavor of that musical version of Joyce.
Through my work on Burgess and his music, one of the first questions that's always asked is, what is his music like? You know, what's it like? And that's not an easy question to answer, because Burgess's music was not just like one thing. There were a lot of different Burgess musics. And one was a kind of serious classical music, that kind of chordal harmony music we were discussing a few moments ago. But Burgess loved popular music. And so there was a lot of popular music. And he liked jazz to a certain extent. Although, as shown in some of the other essays, he had a somewhat ambivalent attitude towards jazz as well. But English music hall, he loved it, and there's some of that in here. He dabbled with some 20th century modernist techniques. He dabbled in 12-tone music just a little bit. All of that is mixed up in this wild Ulysses stew. So we get it starts off with an overture that is quite modern sounding, and then you immediately get into kind of easy listening kind of music. There's one great number, Copulation Without Population, which sounds like it came right off a music hall stage of from 1900. Blooms of Dublin is probably the piece, it's certainly Burgess's longest piece, several hours long. And there's you get the whole panorama of Burgess's musical world in this opera. So it would be great to have it performed. And I think if Burgess had one wish for his music, it probably would have been for a performance of Blooms of Dublin. I think that this piece probably meant more to him than anything else. You know, it's interesting, Andrew, you mentioned this musicalizing Ulysses essay, and this was a typescript, and I'm not sure that this was published previous to this publication in this volume. Are you aware of anywhere that it was published? He clearly wrote it for people to publish, but I'm not sure anyone did.
I'm not sure about that. As you say, we only have the typescript in the archive. We haven't got a copy of the published piece. It may not have been published. I mean, some pieces were, but by no means everything.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons I was keen to try to compile this collection is that, you know, many of these essays, you know, only appeared once and fleetingly, at least they did appear. I mean, if you are enough of a detective, you could look up a lot of these essays. But there were a few really important writings of Burgess on music, like this Musicalizing Ulysses, which just are not have never been published before. So So there's a handful of these, which I'm glad they finally made it into print.
Right. And it's also very good to have the translations or the English originals of essays written for publication in Italian or French or German appearing for the first time, certainly in English, and certainly for the first time in book form.
And some of these are pretty important ones. Like there's a remarkable summation of Wagner's Ring. Yeah, it's about 12 pages long, and it only ever appeared in the Italian press before. It's really a masterful summary of the Ring, with a heavy dose of George Bernard Shaw's thoughts about the Ring, flavoring Burgess's own account. There's also an article called Beatlemania about the Beatles, probably Burgess's longest piece about the Beatles. That also was only ever published in Italian before. So yeah, it's great to have some of those in English.
Sure. I think people would be surprised. I mean, both by this late essay on the Beatles from 1992, which modifies and revises some of his much stronger, perhaps even borderline hostile opinions from articles in the 60s. Craig Brown, in his History of the Beatles, he quotes the earlier stuff. He didn't know about this essay, which is published here in English for the first time.
That's one of the very late essays. It was written in 1992, just months before Burgess's death. And he says that in so many words, the Beatles will be forgotten. Who's going to be listening to their music? Well, Paul and Ringo are still selling out arenas all over the world. Burgess doesn't always get it right. He casts doubt on the musicality of the Beatles and their musical excellence. Burgess could not have been more wrong about that, but a lot of it he gets right.
One of the other characters who comes into The Devil Prefers Mozart is Yehudi Menuhin, Burgess's review of his autobiography, but then you reprint the correspondence between them. And there was obviously quite a long-standing friendship there. And we know that Burgess composed a violin concerto for Yehudi Menuhin, though he sadly didn't live long enough to play it. Maybe you could tell me a bit more about Burgess and Menuhin and the violin concerto.
Well, this is a fascinating part of Burgess's life. He and Menuhin met when they both appeared on the same BBC television program in the early 1960s, and they clearly hit it off. And Burgess began some correspondence with Menuhin and also with Menuhin's wife, Diana. And Burgess reviewed Menuhin, and he reviewed some performances of his, a performance of Menuhin playing a Beethoven violin concerto, and he follows that up with a letter to Diana. Very interesting correspondence back and forth. Well, Burgess was a huge fan of Menuhin and decided to honor him with a violin concerto that he wrote in the late 1970s. He wrote it out. He did not keep a copy of the score. He sent it to Menuhin. Menuhin receives the score and says, "This is a remarkable piece. I'm very impressed by your compositional skill. It shows off the violin well. I would love to play this piece, but please understand that an orchestra will have to invite me to play it. I can't just program it myself. The orchestras get to decide what I play in the concerts." Of course, Menuhin, being one of the most sought-after violinists in the world, would have commanded a top fee. And when orchestras bring Yehudi Menuhin to perform with them, they want to hear him play the Beethoven or the Brahms or the Tchaikovsky or any of the standard repertoire pieces, Bartok, but no one was going to hire him to premiere the Anthony Burgess Violin Concerto, unfortunately. So even though Menuhin had very kind things to say about this piece, he never did have the opportunity to play it. And then when I began my research into Burgess and his music, I was very, very keen to try to find this violin concerto, the score. Burgess didn't keep a copy of it for himself. And I went to the Menuhin School in Surrey, and they were very kind. There were all kinds of cabinets that were locked. And they knew that there was music behind the cabinets, and they brought in a locksmith, and he opened up all the cabinets, and I spent an entire day going through their library. Unfortunately, the manuscript was nowhere to be found. And I asked them, if it ever turns up, please to let me know. And I was very doubtful that it ever would show up. But after Menuhin died, I forget exactly the year, I think it was around 2000 or so, the manuscript did turn up and they did contact me, and I was able to see it and eventually to get a microfiche of the score. The violin concerto is, we talked earlier about Elgar, and this maybe is the most Elgarian piece that Burgess ever composed. It has that kind of romantic, harmonic language. It has that kind of nobility. It's really a beautiful piece. It has still never been performed. It's on my short list of the two or three Burgess pieces that I would love to perform and actually hear what they sound like. There's still no set of parts, so some enterprising person might want to create a performing edition of the violin concerto. Burgess wrote this piece, which Menuhin admired. Burgess then reviewed Menuhin's autobiography, Unfinished Journey, and the two men were obviously they were friends, they admired each other. How much time they actually spent together, that would be very interesting to know. Menuhin does invite Burgess to attend a concert in Monte Carlo when he goes and plays with the orchestra there. And I believe that Burgess did attend the concert and have dinner with Menuhin and his wife afterwards, probably with Princess Grace and Prince Rainier also. It's difficult to know how much time they saw each other in England. Burgess didn't have too many, I think, friends that he saw on a regular basis. I mean, his world was one of sitting at a desk and writing his music and his books. Would you concur with that, Andrew? Do you think there was much room in Burgess's life for those kinds of in-person friendships?
I'd agree that a lot of his friendships were conducted at a distance, often by letter. I think there was a short time in the 60s when he was living in London where he saw quite a few of the poets and other writers. In those 8 years or so, or even less than that, when he was in Chiswick for 5 years, I think he was quite sociable, and he would review theatre and he was going to all the parties and so forth. But beyond that, I think once he starts traveling around and living in different places and often living in more than one place at the same time, he's not really kind of rooted or connected in a way that would allow him to do that. Until he comes to Monaco, I think that there were genuine friendships, especially with the people at the Princess Grace Library, these lovers of Irish literature. I guess that was a sort of social thing for him as well. I also think that Burgess collected musicians, interestingly, and you've pointed out in your own work that he composed for the three great harmonica players. Larry Adler, I wanted to ask you about, but maybe you could tell us a bit more about Burgess and the harmonica. It's an important part of this book and a part of his life as a composer.
Yeah, and that is one friend that he did make. This is John Sebastian, the harmonica virtuoso, whose son John Sebastian then became quite a well-known American rock star as the lead singer of the Love and Spoonful. But John Sebastian, the harmonica player, lived in Rome when Anthony Burgess moved to Rome, and the two of them found each other, and Burgess ended up writing several pieces for John Sebastian. Again, this is somebody that Burgess really admired. Burgess wasn't writing a lot of music at the time. This was around 1972. And when John Sebastian found out that he was a composer, he asked him to write some pieces for harmonica and guitar. And Burgess wrote these two pieces, and John Sebastian took them. He used to go on tour, and we believe that he played these pieces on tour, but we don't have a lot of evidence of it. whether programs of those performances exist, it's hard to say. And those pieces themselves were considered lost for decades. And in fact, I was able to find them in the course of researching this book. They were at a very unlikely archive at an American university. And there's also an essay that Burgess wrote about John Sebastian for a book that was written to honor him after his death by a different friend of John Sebastian's. I also tracked that book down in the course of working on the research for this. And there's only one copy of that book available, and it's at a rather obscure library in the state of Kansas. But at least now we know why Burgess wrote that article. So that's the John Sebastian side. But Andrew, you mentioned that Burgess wrote for the three great harmonica players, and that's true. Larry Adler was living in London, and Burgess knew Larry Adler a bit, also reviewed his autobiography, and met him at a cocktail party and said, you know, I would love to write a piece for you. And he sent Adler first one piece and then another. Adler never played either one. Unlike John Sebastian, Adler wasn't much of a fan of Burgess's music. And I had a chance to interview Larry Adler just towards the very end of his life. And I went to London and asked him what he thought. And he liked Burgess very much as a person, he said, but I don't like his music very much. It's too modern. It's too fancy. He said over and over, I'm a melody man. I'm a melody man. And Burgess didn't write enough melodies for me. So Larry Adler said he had the music in his flat there. I asked him and pleaded with him if there weren't a way for us to like take a look at it, but he just wasn't interested. So that's a piece that unfortunately I don't know if we'll ever see that. Larry Adler's passed away, and after he died, I think I even contacted his daughter to ask if she could send the music if she ever found it, but that hasn't come through. And then there's a romance that Burgess wrote for Tommy Riley, and they played it together on the BBC on I think it Oscar Peterson's television show. That's a very nice piece, and that's for piano and harmonica. And so, yeah, Burgess is probably the only man who ever wrote music for the three great 20th century harmonica virtuosos, John Sebastian, Tommy Riley, and Larry Adler.
It's a good story. It also reminds me, I mean, especially the business of the Adler piece, which seems to be lost for now. There is still more to find out. I mean, I've been looking for years for the Houdini musical that Burgess wrote for Orson Welles. And it showed up. It's in the catalog of one of the Welles archives in Spain, and they can't find it. It must be there somewhere. And one day, you know, I think it's only the libretto. I'm not sure the music ever got written. But, you know, it seems to me from what you're saying, life is still full of these kind of ghost productions by Burgess, which we think are out there somewhere and may one day bubble to the surface.
The book that I wrote previously, A Clockwork Counterpoint, about Burgess's music and his literature, as soon as that was published, a whole spate of pieces were found. There's the Rhapsody for tuba and orchestra, and there's the Concerto for flute and strings from the 1950s, and a whole bunch of other pieces, at least a dozen pieces that have turned up since that book was written.
Right, and things come up for sale as well. The foundation's bought a couple of pieces of music which were offered for auction, or sometimes people approach us directly and say, you know, I've got this thing that belonged to my parents and can I donate it? So, you know, I have the sense that not just with music, but with letters and literary manuscripts, there's more out there still than we know about at the moment. I wonder if we can begin to summarize both the book and your own experience of putting it together. My question here is, What have you learned in the process of compiling this collection of essays? And have you been surprised by any of the discoveries you've made as you've been pulling it together?
There were many things that you know, I was delighted to find and to be able to include in this book. Essays on Mozart, for instance, that I hadn't known about. All these writings on punk, you know, food and music, for instance. I can't think of anyone else who's ever written an essay on food and music. Essays on George Grove. Burgess wrote quite a bit about the Grove Dictionary of Music, the one that was published in 1980. It's great to be able to find more of the writings about his own music. But it's overwhelming. I mean, this book is 500 something pages. If one were to collect all of Burgess's journalism, I can't imagine how many thousands of pages that would be. There have been a few collections of it, but it's just a sampling. And if somebody wants to come along and really grapple with the totality of Burgess's journalism, that's a mammoth undertaking. And I'm not sure, Andrew, that anyone's really grappled with that as a whole yet.
I think there's too much there to justify a series of, I don't know, kind of 25 volumes, because you've said that this large book of music essays is maybe 5% of his writing. But I think you could do it online. And I look at the example of the T.S. Eliot estate, who have built this huge database of all of Eliot's critical writing and his prose writing. And a few published volumes have come out of that, but primarily it's something that you access online. Unfortunately, you have to subscribe to get in there. But I can see this as a research project, and it would take quite a lot of time in terms of digitization and maybe annotation as well. But one of the things that perhaps the Burgess Foundation can do is to build this online repository of journalism, which ideally would be free of access, and people could search it and read it and get a much clearer sense of his critical writing. Even the small reviews, books he reviewed for the Yorkshire Post, it would be interesting to know what he thought of The Golden Notebook or Catch 22 or Pale Fire or any of these books he was reviewing week by week for the Yorkshire Post, for example. And the totality of his writing for The Observer and The Independent and The Times Literary Supplement, as you say, you know, over 30-something years, this is a huge volume of cultural commentary. And you've also got his theatre reviews and his restaurant reviews and a whole load of things that maybe aren't quite visible at the moment. I mean, we've been right around the houses with Burgess and his multitudinous musical interests in this book of essays. It would be very interesting to know, as a final question, about your own upcoming project as a conductor and as a composer.
There are a couple of upcoming Burgess performances that I'm going to be conducting. One is the In Memoriam Princess Grace. This is a piece that Burgess wrote in 1982, just days after Princess Grace's tragic automobile accident. And they were quite good friends in Monaco. And I've programmed this piece once or twice in the past. It's for string orchestra. And this upcoming June, the Stanford Symphony Orchestra, which I lead in California, is going to be going on a two-week tour of France and Monaco. And our final concert will be at the Auditorium Prince Rénier Troyes, which is where the Monaco Professional Orchestra performs. Beautiful concert hall. And I thought that it would be very appropriate to include the In Memoriam Princess Grace when we play it there. And we're hoping that Prince Albert and his wife will be at the performance. So I think that would be quite meaningful. Also, the Mela Quartet is this extraordinary quartet and recently won an international competition. And their prize consists in part of a tour, upcoming tour of the United States. And so they're coming to California in March of 2025, and we're planning to perform the Concerto for Guitar Quartet and Orchestra, the Concerto Grosso for Guitar Quartet and Orchestra. It was played, I think, only once before. Really attractive piece. It's a piece I've wanted to play for a long time. Of course, you need a world-class guitar quartet to pull it off, and now we have that, and we have an excellent orchestra to play it with. So those are the two upcoming performances of Burgess's music. In terms of my own compositions, I just wrote a piece that was a commission to write a piece for 12 pianos. And we premiered this in San Francisco last month. And it was a wild and wonderful experience. We had two sold-out performances in Grace Cathedral that sits at the very top of the highest hill in San Francisco. And now the idea of having a piece for 12 pianos has kind of caught the imagination of a number of people. And now performances are planned throughout the U.S. And hopefully I'll be going down to South America for a performance of it in Colombia in November. And we'll see. Maybe we can find somewhere in the U.K. that they would like to perform this piece for 12 pianos. There are not a lot of pieces for that combination. It's the kind of thing that I'm sure if anyone had asked Anthony Burgess to write a piece for 12 pianos, he would have said, absolutely, and probably would have had it done within a week.
We should come to Manchester. I'm sure the Royal Northern College of Music has at least 12 pianos, all in tune, more to the point. It would be great to see you here. Congratulations, Paul, on the book of essays, which is out now in the UK, also in the United States. It's a real monument and achievement, and I'm sure that people want to read it.
And Andrew, I can't let this podcast end without thanking you for your contribution to this book, because that you know your contribution was also extremely important, because you brought essays to my attention that I hadn't known about, and with your compendious knowledge of all things to do with Anthony Burgess, we're able to correct things here and there that no one else would have been able to do. So thank you so much for that.
Pleasure to talk to you, Paul. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to the International Anthony Burgess Foundation podcast. The Devil Prefers Mozart, On Music and Musicians by Anthony Burgess, edited by Paul Phillips, is out now from Carcanet. For more information about Anthony Burgess, and to find out how to support the work of the Burgess Foundation, visit anthonyburgess.org and sign up for our weekly newsletter at anthonyburgessfoundation.substack.com.